It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
It was late Friday afternoon, and I just had this sixth sense that something was going to happen. It had been a relatively slow week politically. Both Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis were out campaigning in Iowa. DeSantis is dealing with the fallout over his remarks on Ukraine. And there was no sign of the indictment of Donald Trump. I knew it wasn't going to happen on a Friday because they wouldn't want to sort of blow it off to the weekend. And I just, as I was preparing Media Buzz, everything was too neat. It was too set. And there's a rhythm to these things. Well, Saturday morning I get up, and I always have to spend the morning, you know, finishing up on the show. 7:26 a.m., boom, Donald Trump, Truth Social, I will be arrested on Tuesday. And it was like watching a neutron bomb go off. I mean, but not as quickly as you might expect. I kept refreshing, and no story in the New York Times, no story in Politico, no story in the Washington Post. I think everybody was trying to report it out and be kind of cautious. Television, not so much. But there was an incredible split between CNN and Fox News, which were reporting it, but only occasionally, and MSNBC, which called in every name, every star. Every person who worked there was calling in. Wall-to-wall coverage, just not covering anything else. And of course, here's the thing. If it was true, and we all were expecting that there would be an indictment, probably this week, then whatever you think of the case, and I've made clear, I think that this is by far the weakest of the cases against Donald Trump, and a flawed case in and of itself. And it's not just me. I mean, we played some sound on Media Buzz yesterday. I hope you had a chance to see the show. If not, the segments are online. And by the way, I hope you had a good weekend. Don't want to leave that part out. And, you know, you had Dan Abrams coming out and saying this is a bad case politically and legally. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, Trump's nemesis, saying, you know, Trump doesn't know what evidence they have, but this is a trivial case. And on and on. I mean, here you have the former president of the United States being investigated for January 6th, for mishandling of classified documents, for possible election interference in Georgia, and we're all going to get super upset and excited about Stormy Daniels. But nevertheless, there was the post on Truth Social. I will be arrested Tuesday. Former president of the United States of America, corrupt prosecutor in Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, and then at the end, protest, take our country back. Well, a lot of time was spent on that. And I'm thinking, first of all, it wasn't like Donald Trump was saying would be wild, but when you looked at the headlines when the papers finally got around to writing about this story, and how do you not write about it, by the way? Even though, and I was wary of this because I'm thinking, well, how does Trump know what day it is? So it turns out he wasn't officially notified. It may not be tomorrow, but it will probably be this week, unless somehow the DA changes his mind. No official notification to Donald Trump. What he was doing was seizing control of the media narrative. And he did it. I mean, here's a guy who's been out of office for more than 2 years. He's campaigning, but he has no formal powers. And yet he completely and totally upended the media and political worlds on Saturday morning. But the business about the protests, New York Times headline said, echoes of January 6th. And I'm thinking, is that really fair? People are allowed to protest in this country. This is a tradition of peaceful protests going back to the founding of the Republic. But of course, at the same time, everybody remembers what happened when he invited protesters to Washington for January 6th. And so I thought that was a little unfair. And yet, I mean, here's Rachel Maddow calling in to MSNBC and saying Trump wants to raise the civic cost of indicting him. That, in other words, he wants political violence, or he wants the threat of political violence to change minds about whether or not he should be indicted. So we tore up the show. I got different guests. I moved segments around. We had to drop some things. Look, you know, that's the nature of live television. So I, you know, my secondary personal thought was, well, my Saturday is shot because it took a lot of time to deal with that. But on the other hand, if Trump was going to force this into the news, just as well from my point of view, that he do it the day before my show, then if this happens, you know, tomorrow and I have to wait another 5 days. Anyway, so now there have been some new developments. We found out yesterday that the former legal advisor to Michael Cohen, who, of course, is the key witness in this case, if it is brought, and went to jail for a number of reasons, but this is one of them, writing a $130,000 check to Stormy Daniels to keep her allegations from coming out at the end of the 2016 campaign. Well, this former legal advisor is Robert Costello, lawyer who's been around in prominent New York cases for a long time. He is testifying before the grand jury today and is thought to be the last witness. News Nation reports that Costello met with Trump's attorneys in the case, and he claims to have information that contradicted Michael Cohen's current statements and could be exculpatory for Trump, according to a source. New York Times confirming that Costello will testify today, and this didn't just happen. It happened because Trump's lawyers made it happen. So Trump goes to the Truth Social. You know, he's back on, he has the right to be back on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. He's posted just, "Hi, I'm back" on Facebook. Hasn't done anything on Twitter. Anyway, a highly respected lawyer who once represented convicted felon, jailbird, and serial fake storyteller and liar Michael Cohen, this is all caps, will be doing so tomorrow afternoon, meaning Monday afternoon. The information he'll present will supposedly be conclusive and irrefutable. Witch hunt, 3 exclamation points. CNN talked to Costello, who's also represented Steve Bannon in the past. He confirmed that he will be doing this. He has previously recounted, and this goes to the heart of the defense, that Cohen told him he paid off Stormy Daniels to protect Melania Trump, and that Cohen saw a pardon from Trump, according to the Wall Street Journal. And Costello can do this because Cohen, back in 2019, waived his attorney-client privilege so that Costello could testify at that time. Costello saying, "I think I have an ethical obligation to report what I know. I don't know, you know, is this going to suddenly turn around, District Attorney Alvin Bragg?" But, you know, when he says protect Melania Trump, what he really means is protect Donald from Melania Trump, because that's the alternative explanation. Not to get too down into the weeds, but this would ordinarily be a misdemeanor case. And I don't even know that it would be brought against an ordinary citizen. But Alvin Bragg, elected as a Democrat, no fan of Trump, is trying to upgrade the misdemeanor charge to a felony by tying it to a campaign finance violation. Leaving aside that a lot of lawyers think this is a stretch. And if it's a misdemeanor case, then so what? It's easily disposed of. Not that I think there's nothing wrong with paying hush money to somebody to shut them up, but it was a confidentiality agreement, like an NDA. It happens all the time. But if you look at it, what he really was trying to do, this is the alternate explanation that another of Trump's lawyers claimed, is protect Donald Trump from embarrassment with his wife, Melania, over payments that took place 6 years ago over an alleged one-night sexual encounter that took place 17 years ago. So on this business of the protests, Kevin McCarthy came out yesterday and said people should not protest if there is an indictment, which he also called an abuse of power by Alvin Bragg, even though Bragg hasn't done it yet. And he said, I don't think people should protest this, no. And I think President Trump, if you talk to him, he doesn't believe that either. Well, I don't understand that second sentence from the House Speaker. Trump hasn't issued a new statement, taking back the old statement. He says, protest, take our country back. And I just have to interject here, this whole take our country back rhetoric. The only way that Donald Trump gets to take the country back is if he wins the Republican nomination, which is actually pretty likely, and he wins a general election, which is a much tougher challenge for him, given what's happened over the last 6 years. Otherwise, I don't know, what take our country back because the protests, the demonstrations will be so overwhelming that the district attorney will not bring these charges. I mean, Bragg's office felt compelled to put out a memo yesterday saying we will not be intimidated by any of this rhetoric, but safety will be the utmost concern. So it's interesting because a lot of people probably didn't pay that much attention to the Stormy Daniels at the time or have since forgotten the details. So the New York Times has this hold here. You may not remember what he did with the porn star, but here we're going to remind you. Turns out they met when Trump, this is 2006, went to a golf tournament without his third wife, Melania, who remained behind with their newborn son. And they were photographed together. You've probably seen that picture 140,000 times. He invited her to dinner. He wore black silk pajamas, according to Stormy. Told her that she should be on The Apprentice, which he was then hosting for NBC. She doubted it. He assured her he could. Afterwards, they would occasionally have phone calls. And then finally, there was the alleged one-night affair. They did not sleep together again, even by her account. He never put her on The Apprentice. She kept calling. Oh, he kept calling, Stormy says. Eventually, she stopped answering, I guess because she was pissed. So, in 2011, Trump was toying with the idea, or actually, it was more of a publicity stunt, really, that he was going to run for president. And since he was back in the news, Stormy Daniels began working with an agent to sell the story of their liaison. And they negotiated a $15,000 deal with the celebrity magazine Life and Style. And she was asked, did this really happen? Just to impress you, to try to sleep with you? The reporter asked, yeah, and I guess it worked. The whole business about it. Anyway, Trump then doesn't run, stays at The Apprentice. Her story ends up on a gossip blog called The Dirty. I'd forgotten about this part because I'm much more familiar with the 2016 part. So her career was going nowhere. So Stormy comes back in 2016, as does a woman named Karen McDougal, a Playboy playmate, hiring the same lawyer who had helped Stormy in the years earlier. And American Media, which is the National Enquirer, or was at that time, agreed to pay Karen McDougal, excuse me. There's so much money floating around here, it gets a little confusing. $150,000 for the exclusive rights to her story about Trump. Then what happened is, there's a lot of back and forth, and then the Access Hollywood comes out. It completely upends the campaign. Even Trump has to apologize. And suddenly, Stormy realizes that she's in a much stronger position. She, in this environment, she makes this public. She could sink Donald Trump's candidacy. And that's when Michael Cohen agreed to pay $130,000 for what's called in the tabloid world catch and kill. The National Enquirer, run by a close friend, David Pecker of Donald Trump's, would buy the rights to Stormy's story and then bury it. And that's where we are now. It's just amazing to me. You know, usually a candidate for president or any office, really, wouldn't be boasting about the fact that you're about to be arrested and indicted. And by the way, I don't think that's going to be a perp walk or any of that. I think this will all be done discreetly, but there will be a mugshot undoubtedly. There will be fingerprints undoubtedly. But I would be surprised if there was anything more than that, assuming this does happen. I'll keep you posted. You might hear something about this.
Don't go anywhere. More BuzzMeter coming your way in just a moment.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow Podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Story 2. Andrew Sullivan, in his Weekly Dish, writes about Ron DeSantis and Ukraine. But really, he's writing about a much broader thing, and that is whether our politics is starting to return to normal. I always like, as a writer, to be able to tie together two or three different events and to show that there's a pattern or that there is a larger narrative or truth to be pulled out of seemingly separate stories. So, what Andrew says is, look, DeSantis may dismiss this as territorial dispute, which is undoubtedly what Moscow would say, of this brutal invasion. But it is at some level a border dispute, says Sullivan. The entire post-Soviet settlement was a redrawing of national borders. The war has to come to an end at some point, and at some point they'll have to be drawing some kind of borderline. You know, does Putin get to keep Crimea, but has to pull out of Donbass and those other areas? Putin, by the way, visiting Mariupol, I guess, to show that, you know, the Russians are firmly in charge. And Xi of China visiting Moscow today, and that's an alliance that should really worry the United States. So Andrew says the blob, meaning, you know, the whole media foreign policy gang, declares Munich. And DeSantis is Neville Chamberlain, bowing to Hitler. A lot of people making 1930s Germany analogies. Washington Post, appeasement. Anyway, I don't get it, says Sullivan. It's surely perfectly fine for a country to have two political parties that differ on foreign policy. It's a critical advantage that democracies have over more rigid regimes. Helps us correct mistakes sometimes. Change personnel, adjust to a changing reality. Of course, the weird thing here is that when I was growing up, for years and years and years, it was the Republicans who were the party of national security. It was the Republicans who were the party of tough on the commies, tough on the Soviet Union. It was the Democrats who were being accused of being soft on communism, of not recognizing the threats that these other countries posed. That was part of the rationale for George W. Bush going into Iraq, which, by the way, the 20th anniversary of that misbegotten invasion, with all due respect to all the people who fought in that war for the United States, turned out not to be the greatest foreign policy move of all time. We're now seeing pictures of the battleship with the mission accomplished banner and all that. Anyway, going back to Andrew, it's flipped now. It's the Democrats who are seen as, you know, too quick to mount these foreign interventions. And it's the Republicans who are like, yeah, you know, Putin, not that big a deal, territorial dispute, and so on. The fact is, says Sullivan, DeSantis is pretty much where Obama was on Ukraine in 2014, hardly a right-wing fanatic. And what President Obama said after the Crimea invasion was, the fact is that Ukraine, which is a non-NATO country, is going to be vulnerable to military domination by Russia no matter what we do. Well, of course, it's right on Russia's border. So the larger narrative I'm talking about is, he then connects it to Joe Biden moving to the center, and there's been three straight things that have happened here, and it is no coincidence in my view, allowing a big Alaska oil drilling project, though he had promised not to do that kind of thing during the campaign, vetoing the D.C. crime overhaul, where suddenly minimum sentences either abolished or greatly reduced for all kinds of serious violent crimes. And then the third thing was making changes, or certainly considering making changes, toward a more Trumpian policy at the border. So he's saying, Sullivan's writing here on his Substack, that Biden has conceded what conservatives have been saying for years. The asylum system is being gamed to allow mass economic migration. So if Biden is moving toward the center on that, and of course he's a completely different position than Ron DeSantis on Ukraine, maybe it's a healthy thing, says Andrew, that both parties or leading figures in both parties are now starting to sort of adjust their positions, and that this is a more normal type of political discourse. He goes on to say, the over-the-top condemnation of DeSantis is not helpful in my view. DeSantis has plenty of flaws, but as even the MSNBC neocons concede, he is not Trump. And a more realist foreign policy is not some type of Chamberlain-style appeasement of a fascist menace. It's about measuring the costs as well as the benefits of defending Ukraine and Taiwan, by the way, indefinitely with all our might. It's about managing a declining Russia and its S-army and nuclear warheads. It's about checking China without pointlessly suppressing that great civilization's future role in the world. So all of that seemed to me to be an interesting take, tying together these different foreign policy and domestic threads. Story number three, a remarkable piece of reporting by Peter Baker in the New York Times, having to do with Jimmy Carter, who of course is currently in hospice care. And since I was a journalist during the Iranian hostage crisis, which lasted for more than a year, which basically sunk Carter's presidency. I mean, whether or not Ronald Reagan could have defeated him in 1980, if there had been no hostage crisis, certainly the Carter people believed that would not have happened. But you also had double-digit inflation and unemployment, and we don't know how that hypothetical would have turned out. But here's what we do know. A guy named Ben Barnes, well-respected former Speaker of the Texas House, youngest ever to serve in that position, and Lieutenant Governor of Texas, has kept a secret, according to this Times piece, for 43 years. And that secret is this, that John Connally, former Governor of Texas, John Connally was sitting right next to JFK in the limo in 1963 in Dallas when President Kennedy was assassinated and Connally was wounded. He was a major political force. He then kind of moved to the right, and the Republicans loved him. Richard Nixon made him Secretary of the Treasury and wanted him to succeed him as president. Other events intervened. In any event, Ben Barnes of Texas now says that former Governor John Connally, in the summer of 1980, took him on a tour of Middle Eastern capitals, passing a message to regional leaders, asking them to tell this to Iran. Don't release the hostages before the election. Reagan will win and give you a better deal. After returning home, Connally reported to William Casey, the chairman of Reagan's campaign, later director of the CIA, briefed him about the trip. Jimmy Carter's camp has long suspected that something like this happened. And Barnes, on the record, feels compelled to correct that record, saying history needs to know that this happened. He's 85 years old, or about to be 85. I think it's so significant, and I guess knowing that the end is near for President Carter put it on my mind more and more and more. I just feel like we've got to get it down some way. Now, how do we know this is true? Well, Barnes identified four people who are still alive, because a lot of the other people, Casey, Connally, have long since passed on, that he said he had confided in over the years. All four of them confirmed to Peter Baker that Barnes had shared the story with them years ago. Records at the LBJ Museum or Library confirmed part of Barnes' story. There was an itinerary found in Connally's files indicating that he did, in fact, in July of 1980, leave Houston and go to Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Israel before returning home, and Barnes was listed as accompanying him. So the trip happened, and the only question is what happened on the trip. But here's Barnes on the record saying, you know, he feels guilty. I have to take a second here to explain to you how outrageous this is, because I don't remember the exact number, but 40 or 42 of our Iranian embassy hostages were just living a miserable life, being held by the government. So it was just absolutely insane. And for them, for their return to be delayed even by one day or 1 week or 1 month is absolutely abysmal. It's horrible. It's appalling. It's shameful just to help Reagan win the election. I mean, using them in a way as political prisoners. And it's also reminiscent of what Richard Nixon did when he sent messages to Vietnam saying, you know, wait till I'm elected, you'll get a better deal, as opposed to reaching some kind of peace settlement with Lyndon Johnson. So, you know, the Times story says, look, you can't, there's no proof that Reagan knew about this. It's hard for me to imagine he didn't, but let's just say he didn't. Did the messages transmitted to the Middle Eastern leaders in all these countries get through to the Iranians? Did it influence what the Iranians did? I don't know. But Iran did hold the hostages until after the election. Of course, Reagan won. And did not release the hostages until minutes after noon on January 20th, 1981, when Carter left office. Connally said, this is according to Barnes, look, Ronald Reagan's going to be elected president, and you need to get the word to Iran that they're going to make a better deal with Reagan than they are Carter. He said it would be very smart for you to pass the word to the Iranians to wait until after this general election is over. And boy, I tell you, I'm sitting there and I heard it, and so now it dawns on me, I realize why we're here. And again, I understand how guilty Ben Barnes must feel with Jimmy Carter, you know, in his final days. And, you know, once the election was over, Ronald Reagan is the president-elect in early November of 1980, couldn't the Iranians, I mean, they hated Carter, and Carter, of course, had the failed rescue mission where a bunch of helicopters crashed in the desert, but couldn't they have released the hostages then? I mean, Reagan could have taken credit somehow. Another 3 months before our American men and women would come home. And so this is not just some footnote to history. It's a really huge and embarrassing, as I was saying, appalling development history. And again, I'm not saying Reagan knew about this or authorized it, but I'm pretty convinced based on the evidence gathered in this story that it happened.
Don't go anywhere. More BuzzMeter coming your way in just a moment.
Number four, Ron DeSantis ought to get used to this because he had a whole life and career before becoming a congressman and then winning the election for governor of Florida in 2018. So there's going to be more and more scrutiny on him. Here's a Washington Post story saying that DeSantis was a 27-year-old Navy lawyer just out of Harvard Law School. I love when he runs against the elites because he went to Harvard and Yale. But just out of Harvard Law School, when he arrived at Gitmo, he arrived at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where many enemy combatants were being held without charges. They were on a hunger strike. And there was a lot of pressure to end these protests. And DeSantis himself later said he was part of a team of military lawyers asking what could be done. How do I combat this? A commanding officer asked in 2006. As DeSantis recalled in an interview years later with a local CBS station. Hey, DeSantis said, you can actually force feed. Saying this in his role as a legal advisor. Here's what you can do. Here's kind of the rules for that. Ultimately, it was the Pentagon's decision, certainly not Ron DeSantis's, but it was his advice, to authorize force feeding of these detainees who were on a hunger strike. This is pretty hard to read. They were strapped into a chair, and a lubricated tube was stuffed down their nose so a nurse could pour down 2 cans of a protein drink, according to military records. The detainees' lawyers tried and failed to stop the painful practice, arguing that it violated international torture conventions. It's not like I feel sorry for the people who held at Gitmo. They were mostly terrorists, or accused of terrorist acts. Hardened criminals, in other words. 17 years later, DeSantis largely skimmed over that whole situation in a book, a memoir that he just published.
He's rarely talked about it. Independent groups have argued that these were human rights violations. DeSantis had an up-close and personal view of some of the most disturbing incidents at this detention camp, according to a review by the Washington Post of public records, media reports, interviews, including with DeSantis' commanding officer, who said he was the one who authorized this. DeSantis said in that CBS interview in 2018, "What I learned from that is they are using things like detainee abuse offensively against us. It was a tactic, technique, and procedure." So he's justifying the force feeding by saying this was what was being done by these detainees in an effort to get publicity for themselves and make the U.S. look like heartless and oppressive. Two former detainees interviewed by the Post also said they vividly recalled interacting with DeSantis but didn't know his name until he became governor of Florida. Admiral Harry Harris, who oversaw Gitmo at the time, said he had no regrets about anything that occurred and was very proud of those who served with him. All right, let me get to number five. I know I talk a lot about AI, but here's a piece in The Atlantic that actually made me feel better. Because AI is being, artificial intelligence is being so widely described as life-changing and world-changing, and people are going to lose their jobs, and it can do anything better than a human. So this is not just a question of like winning a chess game. It can write text, it can talk, it can do all this stuff. And we're all going to be obsolete, right? But this piece in The Atlantic, I love this, says, well, you know, these programs may be able to code websites, plan vacations, draft company-wide emails in the style of William Faulkner, but they have the memory of a goldfish. This has me breathing easier. ChatGPT's memory is terrible. Each time a model generates a response, it can take into account only a limited amount of text, known as the context window. Now, ChatGPT has a context window of about 4,000 words, long enough for the average person messing around with it might never notice, but short enough to render all kinds of complex tasks impossible. For example, says The Atlantic, it wouldn't be able to summarize a book, review a major coding project, search your Google Drive. For example, tell ChatGPT your name, paste 5,000 or so words of nonsense into the text box, and then ask what your name is. You can even say explicitly, I'm going to give you 5,000 words of nonsense, then ask you my name. Ignore the nonsense. All that matters is remembering my name. It won't make a difference. ChatGPT won't remember. And ChatGPT-4, this new language-based software, the window is about 8,000 words, so that's better. There's a version that may even have 32,000 words, but for all of that, GPT-4 still can't remember information from one session to the next. Engineers could make the context window 10 times greater or 100 times greater, and this would still be the case. Every time you start a new conversation with GPT-4, you'd be starting from scratch. Every time it's booted up, it's starting anew. So, if it's got the memory of a goldfish, then there's a lot of stuff it's not going to be able to do that will require human brains. Our memories are not flawless, but we're better than this thing. You know, you tell me something today, I'll probably remember it tomorrow. I might even remember it a year from now. ChatGPT, if you have to do it again tomorrow, doesn't remember anything. It's like a newborn baby. All right, enough of that. Jen Psaki, heavily promoted on MSNBC for her new show yesterday. And, you know, watching her, and I knew her a little bit before she became President Biden's press secretary. I mean, she has great on-air skills. She's relaxed, she's funny, she's smart and articulate and so forth. Of course, on this show, she's interviewing people who agree with her. And that takes off some of the tension. Like, she used to be on CNN and she'd go up against various Republicans. And it was interesting to see her debate. But when she's interviewing Hakeem Jeffries and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, the likes of them, you know, she pushed them. She could be a little bit aggressive, but it's all in service of ideas they all agree on. For example, gun control. She declares that as a mom, she's most worried about gun violence. And then she kind of pushes Governor Whitmer on gun control. So I just think that MSNBC and NBC see her as the next Stephanopoulos, that, you know, 2 years from now, when her the memory of her service as press secretary is kind of faded, that she'll be able to be a big star for the network. Perhaps that's easier to do when you're taking a liberal Democrat. But nevertheless, she has this sort of likability quotient. And with that, seems to be going a little long here, but I'm all wound up. I could talk for another hour, but I think I'll give you all a break, okay? We'll be back tomorrow, and unlike ChatGPT-4, I will remember almost everything I've said today so as not to repeat it. Sometimes I repeat things just because I know people that listen every single day. But with that, thanks for listening. See you tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.